It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. There were no casinos in Maryland until 2010. With the opening of the Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore last summer, there are now five, with one more set to open south of Washington at National Harbor in Prince George's County in 2016. The eruption of casinos may be great for people who want to while away an hour or two with a daydream of winning big, but for the estimated 150,000 Marylanders who are addicted to gambling, it creates a terrible temptation. The Center on Problem Gambling, part of the University of Maryland School of Medicine, was created to help those people. In September, I spoke with its program director, Lori Rugel, and Michael Rosen, a clinical social worker and recovering gambling addict who works at the center. I began by asking Michael how long gambling had been a part of his life.
For 28 years, it was a major part of my life from age 10 until age 38.
How did you get caught up in it at age 10?
My father was an alcoholic, workaholic, and compulsive gambler. And when I was 8 years old, he gave me a toy roulette wheel, a felt replica of a dice table, and a felt replica of a blackjack table. And he thought that was a way we could bond. And that was the beginning.
And that
of my fascination. And that turned into a 28-year addiction that got worse and worse as the years went on. In the beginning, it was fun. When I was 10 years old, I actually ran a casino in summer camp. Instead of using money, we used baseball cards. And people used to tease me that if I stayed on the house side, I'd be a multi-billionaire today. But by the time I was 13, I was in a regular poker game. I was fascinated with sports betting, the crap table, casinos. First time I walked into a casino, I was 14 years old. I was 6 feet tall. No one asked me for any ID. And even in my youth, only one time was I ever asked to leave a casino, and that was in Monte Carlo when I was 20, when they carded me and had to be 21.
When did you know you had a problem?
I would say that I knew in college. I would say that I was gambling 4 to 5 days a week, every week in college. Poker, track, sports betting. To say the least, I graduated college by the skin of my teeth.
So you kept gambling even after you knew you had a problem?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It it got worse and worse. And as my career advanced, the more money I made, I was a functional a pathological gambler. The more money I made, the more I gambled. And when I got into the stock market, that's when it really became serious. So, you know, it was telephones to the brokers and the bookies, options and commodities, day trading every day.
And at some point, you stopped.
Yes.
Or you thought, you said, I got to stop this.
In 1981. In 1981, my marriage was on the rocks. My job was in danger. And at one point, I lost $40,000 in 10 seconds. And I said, Michael, you have lost complete control. And I called the GA, Gamblers Anonymous hotline. And a gentleman stayed on the phone with me for an hour and a half, telling me that it would have been nice if I had called when I was 28, but it was good that I called at 38 instead of 48.
And I understand you had actual physical withdrawals.
Oh, absolutely, especially the first 6 months. There were times where I'd sit at my desk and I literally had to grab my right hand with my left hand to stop me from calling a broker or calling a bookie. I had the shakes, anxiety, nervousness. I wanted to gamble. That was my main drug of choice. And I definitely had physical withdrawal.
Lori Rugel, who is at highest risk?
Well, men are still at higher risk than women, but women are catching up. Young men, and the highest risk groups are those groups that are most socially and economically disenfranchised in any given community.
And is that what we see playing out in Maryland?
That's what we see playing out in Maryland. We've already begun to do some research that shows that African Americans are at higher risk than Caucasians, and that those with lower income are at higher risk. In Baltimore City, we just completed a pre-casino survey so that we'll be able to go back after the casinos opened and look and see if the prevalence rates have changed and what groups are most affected.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Lori Rugel, Program Director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling. We're also joined by Michael Rosen, who has struggled with gambling addiction in the past and now works at the center. Before we go on, tell us briefly what the center does.
The Center of Excellence is really responsible for developing a network of treatment providers who can deal with the issue of problem gambling. Prevention, so working with youth and other at-risk groups to prevent people from developing a problem, and informing the public of the warning signs, how to gamble without it becoming a problem, as well as what to do if a problem develops.
And you are involved in running a helpline.
Yes, a 24/7 gambling-specific helpline. Anybody can call and be directed to the resources in their community for help with this issue.
And that number is 1-800-522-4700. I'll say it again at the end of this interview. Do I understand that the funding for your work comes from the state tax on the casinos?
Yes, that's right, through the Behavioral Health Administration. So we fund some research as well as the services that we offer.
But it's not general tax
not
money.
Not general tax dollars. Money. It's money, yeah, from the casino revenues.
And Lori, are there certain kinds of games of chance that pose more risk of addiction than others?
What we find is that games that are rapid action, you get immediate reinforcement, like the slot machines, like the lottery scratch-offs, where you can just keep playing and playing. You don't need somebody else to be there. You can do it by yourself. You don't necessarily need to learn a skill, are the most addictive forms of gambling.
Michael, you mentioned a whole bunch of different kinds of gambling. What was your main addiction?
I was never interested in slot machines. Basically, you have the escape gambler and the action gambler. Without question, I was an action gambler. There was the narcissism, the feeling that I was better than someone else, that I could beat the system. So the crap table, the stock market, poker, blackjack appealed to me. Pressing buttons in a slot machine, I had absolutely no interest in that whatsoever. I've never bought a lottery ticket or bought a scratch-off. That, to me, would be a waste of money.
And you said it was Gamblers Anonymous.
Yes.
That was your way out. What in particular about Gamblers Anonymous?
I think it was the fellowship and the support. When I gambled, I did everything I possibly could to increase my odds of winning. Most of the time it did not work, but I kept trying. When I decided that I needed to go into recovery, I did everything that I possibly could to increase my odds of staying sober, of avoiding relapse. So not only did I go to GA, I also went to individual therapy and group therapy. And, fortunately, I had some therapists that knew something about gambling and that helped me.
How might somebody figure out if they or somebody they love is an addicted gambler?
I think one of the primary signs is they don't stick to limits in terms of time and money. They always spend more and stay longer than they intend to, and it starts having really negative consequences on a person's lives. They don't go to family events. They become preoccupied. They may lie to cover up their losses or how much time they're spending with the gambling, and they may get agitated when they can't get to a game. So you start seeing those signs build up. But mostly, if you can't stick to your limits, and that's what we encourage people to do, to gamble safely, set a limit, time and money, and stick to it. If you can't, that's a problem.
Lori, I understand people can actually ban themselves from casinos.
Yes, they can exclude themselves. They can sign up so that if they go to the casino, they are arrested for criminal trespassing, and they don't get to keep any of their winnings. They still have to pay any of their losses, and they will be taken to court. So it's a significant deterrent for somebody who wants to put obstacles between them and their gambling problems.
Do very many people in Maryland take advantage of that?
Yes, we've had huge success with that, and it's really benefited thousands of people in
their
recovery. Yes.
Can people unban themselves?
They can, after 2 years, apply to be removed from the self-exclusion list.
So you can't do it on the spur of the moment?
You can't do it impulsively, no.
Laurie, the estimate of 150,000 problem gamblers in Maryland, is that likely to grow with more casinos in the state?
Well, the research shows that you have a spike within a few years after casino opens, and then it may even out. But also the research shows that within 10 miles of a casino, you have double the rates of problem gambling. So I think, you know, within the vicinity of casinos, you still are at higher risk across time.
Within 10 miles, and that covers a lot of Maryland these days.
Yes, it does.
I really appreciate you both talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Laurie Rugel is Program Director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling. Michael Rosen is a recovering gambling addict, a clinical social worker, and the center's network development and helpline coordinator. We spoke in September. If you think you might have a gambling problem, you can call their helpline at 1-800-522-4700. We'll have that number on our website and a link to the center's website. That's WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. And again, the helpline number, 1-800-522-4700. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, poems about a lost Maryland town. Stay with us on 88.1.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. I'm Tom Hall. If you celebrated yesterday, I hope you had a great Christmas. The Loch Raven Reservoir is the largest of the three area watersheds that supply more than 400 million gallons of water every day to residents of Baltimore City and Baltimore County. It's also the inspiration for a collection of poems. Ann Kolakowski is a poet who lived for a long time in Baltimore County. She now lives in Montgomery County, and it appears that her grandmother, who died in 2006, was the last surviving resident of the town that was closed down and flooded to create the Loch Raven Reservoir. In 1921, the residents of Warren and the adjacent town of Bosley were told to leave, and their history ran the risk of being literally washed out, until Anne told their story in a book of poems. It's called Persistence, Poems of Warren, Maryland, and we talked about it in June. Tell folks the story. It starts in 1908 when the citizens of Baltimore approved a multimillion-dollar loan to make the water system better.
Yes.
Then what happened?
And that actually sort of reached back a few years to 1904 and, of course, the Great Fire, which absolutely overtaxed the infrastructure of Baltimore. So the city knew it needed to upgrade the water supply and started looking around and said, oh, hey, Gunpowder River looks like a good source. There's only one problem. There's this very vibrant mill town, Warren, in our way. And what happened was the owner of Warren Manufacturing, Summerfield Baldwin, made a secret deal with the water board to sell the town of Warren, whether or not it was ultimately needed, for $725,000, which I tried to do the calculation using the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It doesn't quite go back to 1908, but it was something around $17 million in today's terms. So when the voters approved this $5 million water bill, they were somewhat shocked and dismayed, as you might imagine, to find out shortly thereafter that like 1/7 or 1/8 of the money had already been promised in this secret deal. And what happened then was, you know, great outcry and controversy. There were hearings and there were suits and countersuits and, you know, all kinds of controversy that surrounded that sale that prevented the town from actually being taken until 14 years later. And in the meantime, the town thrived, and people were born, and people died, and they continued to make the cotton that, you know, they'd been known for since 1814. And
So Mr. Baldwin owned Warren Manufacturing. It was a cotton manufacturer. Is that what they made?
They originally made silk and cotton, and in the 1820s, actually, were the only plant in the United States that could take cotton from the cotton boll to the cotton bolt of calico. Also had silk, and then eventually gave way, and by the time it closed, it was making cotton duck, which is what's used for, like, sails and awnings and tote bags.
So Mr. Baldwin owns the company. Mm-hmm. Does he own the town? Is it his to sell?
It is his to sell. There were some privately owned properties, but for all intents and purposes, it was a company town, so he had the right to do that, and all of the folks who lived there basically at his pleasure were then, you know, forced to find other places to go and jobs.
But the long and short of it for the people who lived there was, all of a sudden, 1921, on date certain, the town is going to cease to exist. You've got to get out. And they literally opened the floodgates.
Right. It was actually, the last day of production was February 15th, 1922. But certainly by 1921, they were building this 240-foot dam. And everyone knew that the end was coming. So, you know, you had people celebrating their last Christmases. A lot of people were just moving on because it was, as you said, a foregone conclusion. It was time to go.
So it's kind of like the lost city of Atlantis almost. It's covered with water, this town of Warren, and then also Bosley, the next town. Is it, to this day, I mean, are there parts of the town, anything visible?
There's nothing visible above water. To the best of everyone's knowledge, about 40 feet of silt cover whatever stone foundations are left. And I found an article, I think it was around 1978, a couple of enterprising scuba divers decided they were going to suit up and go down and see what they could find. And I think they made it about 6 feet down before they, you know, got mired in the muck. But there are foundations of buildings up in the hills. And certainly some of the older houses that were now what people consider Warren, like on Warren Road, which then leads to the bridge, there are some of the houses that were there, you know, contemporaneous to the town that's gone.
And the bridge we're talking about is which bridge for folks who live up in that area?
It's the one that goes across Warren Road and then becomes Merriman's Mill.
Mm-hmm. So your grandmother was one of the people who lived in this town at the time that it was flooded over.
She was.
Did she talk to you about this? Is this a story you grew up with as a kid?
Well, I had these sort of strange, my family used to like to fish, and we would spend many Sunday afternoons on the banks of the Loch Raven Reservoir, and I have these strange memories of my parents sort of saying, don't forget to look for the flagpole, and I kind of thought, well, that's a strange thing to tell a child. Why would you be looking for a flagpole in the middle of a reservoir? And so I didn't really process that, and it really did not come together until my grandmother had to move out of her house when she was 99, and my brothers and I were going through her belongings, and I scooped up lots of stuff, and then a couple months later found her school book when I opened it up. I mean, it was something I almost threw away. It's that, you know, nondescript.
It's a little notebook.
It's a little notebook, and I opened it up, and it said, you know, Marion Brown, Domestic Science, Warren School, Maryland. And I thought, well, Warren School, I know there's an elementary school, but it was built in the 80s or something. And what is Warren School, and what is Warren? And it all came tumbling down from there. And happily, I found John McGrain, who's the former county historian, and he just really generously shared all of the research he had done, and that just set me on my quest. And unfortunately, my grandmother did not remember most of the story by the time that, you know, I was starting to learn it. So I've had to sort of piece it together other ways. But because of all the controversy, there's a rich archival record. There were a number of photographs that the Baltimore Sun, you know, they sent when this deal came to light. They sent reporters and, you know, there was all kinds of coverage. There are lengthy court documents and, you know, all kinds of things. A few oral histories. I've tried to meet other people, or I tried at the time to meet anyone else who might have been alive in the town. I've met some other people who have relatives, but I've never met another person who was alive in Warren. So,
Ann Kolakowski, her new book is called Persistence, Poems of Warren, Maryland, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning, and I'm Tom Hall. Let me ask you to introduce us to your grandmother by reading the part of the first poem in the book. It's called Witness.
Yes. It begins with an epigraph. Florence Marion Eichler, who was thought to be the last known surviving resident of Warren, a now vanished Baltimore County mill town, died in her sleep Monday. She was 103. And that's from the Baltimore Sun, July 29th, 2006. It's Labor Day, but even at the age of 99, she will not rest. Tomato plants need water. Only three steps off the porch. A sparrow in a shallow bird bath, she'd meant to fill that too, witnesses the crack of bones as Grandmom tries to brace herself against the fall. The bird attempts to match her cries for help, but no one hears for hours. Window shades, like drowsy eyelids, lower as my grandmother moves against her will to catered living. She packs her worn-out deck of cards, for endless hands of solitaire. I join my brothers on a Saturday to claim what she has left behind. My bin soon fills with food-stained recipes, photos snapped at the 39 World's Fair, my father posing by the Parisphere in Trilon, sewing patterns and six pairs of scissors, one for each decade spent as a Red Cross volunteer, a Methodist church picnic shopping list, 30 heads of cabbage, 16 melons, 7 jars of Miracle Whip, a slender composition book, brownish gray and unremarkable. Months pass before I open it to read her fading schoolgirl script. Marion Brown, Domestic Science, Warren School, Maryland. I've never heard of Warren. A local road and school, but not a town, can claim that name. I try to press my grandmother for details. She shakes her head and smiles. No, it's too late. Her memories are silted over Warren's stone foundations. So I am left to weave the story on my own. The mill, the town, the secret deal, the dam, the flagpole, the flood, the reservoir. Her childhood home. Erased.
Anne Kolakowski reading from her new collection of poems, Persistence, Poems of Warren, Maryland. It's a great poetic read, but it's also a history lesson. I mean, you do get the whole story through the epigraphs before the poems, the little clips from the newspapers and whatnot. You have an understanding for how this story developed, and the poetic insight is for the people, the personalities and the human beings directly affected.
And I thank you for noticing that. It certainly was intentional. But for me, the story has always been about the emotional heart and the emotional loss. I mean, the buildings, yes, they were from the photographs. They looked very charming. And I keep thinking that would be a great town to live in today. It would be a nice little arts colony, but that won't be. But for me, it's always been about telling the stories of the people who live there. And certainly I drew inspiration in my own craft from Edgar Lee Masters and the Spoon River Anthology, which I certainly won't say my book is anywhere near like that masterpiece, but it gave me the confidence to give voice and to inhabit lives that to take poetic license, I believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell us about the title poem, Persistence. Why? What is persistence? How does that pertain to this subject?
Yeah, persistence. To me, it starts with water and the persistence of water and how water will weave its own way and carve its path no matter what. So certainly that happened. You know, the flood has managed to create what we all, you know, I drink from the Lochraven Reservoir too, so, you know, I can't say that I didn't benefit from it, but it's a persistence of story, and also in this case, a persistence of myth, because there are a lot of just crazy stories that still exist, and one of them that I refer to in the poem is my grandfather used to tease my grandmother. They were married, I think it was 60 years, and he used to claim that he rescued her off the flagpole. And the reference to the flagpole is that when they destroyed the town, they left the flagpole that stood outside the schoolhouse, and it was wooden, and it poked up out of the water for about 25 years and then finally rotted and drifted away. So, yeah.
So let's have you read it. Persistence.
Persistence, Marion Brown Eichler. It happened a little at a time. The story took on contours as water erased the town. One day, all that was left was what we christened truth. The water was ankle deep when diehards left Warren. Dynamite rubble rained on the schoolhouse with students inside. The spring had magic powers. For 60 years, John teased that he found me in Lochraven, clinging to the wooden pole. After 60 years, I believed it. The way an old-time hymn must be true when you sing it with your whole heart.
Anne Kolakowski, her book of poetry about the lost town of Warren is called Persistence, Poems of Warren, Maryland. We spoke last June. We've got more about the book on our website. Come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ahead on Maryland Morning, the story behind Kwanzaa. Stay with us on 88.1.
It's Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. The first celebration of Kwanzaa began 48 years ago today. It's a non-religious festival founded by Maryland native Maulana Karenga to preserve and promote African-American culture. Kwanzaa lasts from December 26th through January 1st. In 2011, for Kwanzaa's 45th anniversary, we invited two scholars from the University of Maryland College Park to talk to us about Kwanzaa's origins and its reception from Black Americans. William Stewart is Assistant Professor of Anthropology, and Sherry Parks is an Associate Professor of American Studies. I asked Sherry Parks whether she celebrates Kwanzaa.
Yes, we do. My family celebrates Kwanzaa.
Tell me about it.
Kwanzaa, as you just pointed out, is something that's very new and constructed. So we constructed our own ritual, partly from commercial products. When my daughter was small, we found a Happy, Happy Kwanzaa song and a children's book that she has read from most of her reading life on each of the days. We have the kanara and we light a candle each day. We actually add in the Black National Anthem, and we sing that. So my daughter is a Black teenager who knows the Black National Anthem. And we give a small gift, usually a book, to her each day of Kwanzaa.
Do you celebrate other holidays?
Oh, sure.
At this
we
time of year?
Basically don't know a holiday we don't like. So it doesn't contradict with Christmas or anything. So we celebrate Christmas. We celebrate Kwanzaa. We, if we're invited, celebrate Hanukkah. It is, I think, like most American holidays, a very flexible holiday. We ethnic minorities retrofit Thanksgiving even. I mean, there's different food. So I think this is the way Americans celebrate holidays.
Dr. Stewart, tell us something about how Kwanzaa got started.
It got started back in the civil rights days. It was one expression of among many of resistance and often creative resistance to the dominant society, as what he was then called Ron, I guess, mm-hmm. Karenga. He was a bit of a controversial person. He had some problems with the law and served some time. But ultimately, and I think this is part of the story of Kwanzaa, moderated some of the views that were, somewhat off-putting to some members of the larger community, but including the larger Black community. For instance, its hostility, or what was seen as hostility to Christianity, for instance. Often charismatic leaders, whether they're forming new social movements or new religious social movements, they often, in fact, have a bit of hyperbole and an aggressiveness in their talk and so on. As they later on are recruiting and so on, there's not infrequently a moderation of this. I think we saw it in Mormonism. We saw it in, even, believe it or not, in a Church of Scientology.
Well, tell me more, both of you, about resistance to it among African-Americans.
Some criticism is that it is not a, quote, real African holiday, that it doesn't pertain to any particular West African tribe. Most slaves came from that part of Africa. My response to that is that I think it reflects the African diaspora, which is what I'm a child of. And it takes a holiday and uses it very much the way Americans do. If you look at the history of Thanksgiving or Mother's Day, which I think is the best analogy of a holiday that was created for a purpose and then moved around and changed, Kwanzaa reflects that. I don't think it needs to reflect a particular tribe, because I don't know what tribe I'm from. Most of us don't. And so we were galvanized by the experience of slavery and Jim Crow, much as Latinos are being galvanized by the anti-immigration experience now, having come from many different countries.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. In December 2011, I spoke with University of Maryland professors Sherry Parks and William Stewart about the history of Kwanzaa and the holiday's reception in the African-American community. I asked Professor Stewart why some of his colleagues have hesitated to embrace the holiday.
Well, the ones who are strongly, maybe even conservatively, African-Americans in their politics as well as in their religion, in fact, see this as dismissive and aggressively and dismissive of Christianity and so on. This is now, this is not a majority voice in the African American community at all, but it's certainly there.
On Kwanzaa's official website, it says that one, quote, should not mix the Kwanzaa holiday or its symbols, values, and practice with any other culture, close quote. Does that tend to support the idea that it should not be celebrated along, say, with Christmas or along with Hanukkah? Or does it not mean that?
I found a website that specifically said that people of other cultures could participate. So I who, quote, owns Kwanzaa? I'm coming from the perspective that Americans mess with things. We change things. Things mutate over time. And I have as much authority as he does, frankly. Holidays don't fall from the sky. People create them for reasons. And I don't think there are rules that, if you look at the history of holidays, that Americans tend to follow in lockstep. We treat them that way. But if you look at the history, and I don't think Kwanzaa is any different.
Dr. Parks, you talked about who owns Kwanzaa. I mean, one of the principles that's celebrated or reflected on is unity. Is it important, if African Americans to have unity, that it be an alternative feast and not a generic feast that anybody can celebrate along with anything else?
I don't think so. We certainly use it, and I think lots of the organizations that recognize that museums, libraries tend to have Kwanzaa celebrations as a moment to pause and think about African American culture and to preserve some aspects of African culture. I don't think there ever was one African American community. And so I don't think that there's anything wrong with variation within the African-American communities.
Dr. Stewart, where do you think observance of Kwanzaa is headed? Do you think it's going to grow, or do you think it's plateaued? Or?
Well, even if it's plateaued, I think it's here for the long haul. I don't see any reason in the minds of those people who attend to it and do it to give it up. It seems to have achieved a lot of its goals, despite the fact that that there is a kind of a creativity in getting the facts, historical facts and so on, not necessarily right. We had the same thing with pan-Indianism. Certainly, both in Africa and in Native America, you had many, many, many cultures, and you didn't have any monolithic culture. The creation, however, of a new sense of national identity or just nationhood, in fact, is a very creative thing and is quite responsive to people's sense of being not invited to the table for literally centuries.
Dr. Parks, what would you say the benefits of celebrating Kwanzaa are?
One, I think rituals help create families. I think that's why we do them. But in a larger sense, I think it is a way to pause and think about African-American communities for people inside and outside.
Well, I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Sherry Parks is an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. William Stewart is an assistant professor of anthropology there. We spoke in December 2011. I'm Sheila Cast. You can find more information about Kwanzaa at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at zekescoffee.com.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1783, the Maryland legislature granted the state's first business charter to the Susquehanna Canal Company. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great holiday weekend. Back with you Monday.